Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody to Paranexus Universe. This is your host, Doug Kelly. My co-host and friend Grant Rumadunst is on vacation again this week, so he will not be joining us. We want to say happy 4th of July for tomorrow if you're in the States. Good to have you listening to the program tonight. We've got Eric Altman with us, a Bigfoot researcher that will be joining us shortly here in just a moment. Before I introduce Eric, please feel free to come to the chat room, give us a call. The call-in number is on the chat room screen, on the broadcast screen. It's 347-945-7799. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to take your questions. Tonight, interesting show with a really great person, really a great guy, Eric Altman. Give you a little bit of background on Eric. He's originally from Greensburg, Pennsylvania, now resides in Jeanette, Pennsylvania. Eric's interest in Bigfoot stems from watching movies Legend of Boggy Creek, I remember that show. I went to the theater to see that, the drive-in actually, and Creature from Black Lake. Eric began researching paranormal subjects such as UFOs, ghosts, and hauntings, and cryptids with an emphasis on the Bigfoot phenomenon in 1980 at the age of 10. Eric spent the next 17 years studying these subjects of paranormal and Bigfoot by educating himself through numerous books, including John Green's Apes Among Us, and Marion T. Place's Bigfoot All Over the Country. A lot of background to Eric. He is the director now of the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society. He's been that since January 2000. His website is pabigfootsociety.com, and we'll be getting to some of the other websites he's got. Eric, welcome to the program. Did I lose Eric?
Boy, yep, I'm here. Well, thank you very much, Doug, for having me on tonight. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You also do your Blog Talk Radio program, Beyond the Edge Radio. I didn't mention that. And that's on Friday nights for you guys, right?
Yeah, Friday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard to 11 p.m. And we, like yourselves, are a paranormal talk radio program, and we'd like to talk the 4D and, you know, all kinds of different unusual subjects.
Well, that sounds great. So you're an old pro at the radio thing, huh?
Yeah, I actually spent about six or seven years in commercial radio, working at several radio stations as an on-air personality back in the early 1990s to about 1997, 98. So yeah, I have a little bit of experience in commercial radio and then the talk radio circuit as well.
Well, good. So you've been studying Bigfoot for a long time, among other paranormal topics as well, UFOs, ghosts, and hauntings, etc. What drew you to Bigfoot?
Well, it's a kind of an interesting story, and at the same time, it's a long story, so I'll try to keep it short.
Hey, we got 2 hours. talk to me, buddy.
Back when I was about 10 years old, back in 1980, and I'm sure many of the listeners, if they're around my age, would remember this.
29, right? Yeah.
37.
Oh, you should have went with the 29, dude.
Yeah, I get that a lot. Though. Everybody says I look like I'm 27, 28 years old. But back in 1980, on Sunday afternoons, when I wasn't outside riding the bike or shooting basketball at the local playground, they used to air stuff on Sunday afternoons around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is called the Sunday Afternoon Drive-In Theater Movie on one of our local channels in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. And they always had the really sappy or really crappy, I should say, B-rated movies. The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, werewolf movies, Frankenstein movies, all those types of really bad B-movies. And they had a movie called Legend of Boggy Creek, which was not a mockumentary, I would call it a docudrama. I guess that would be the best word to
it. Yeah, B-movie anyway.
And it was based on an upright hominid-type creature, or monster, as they called it, the Falk monster, from Falk, Arkansas, that was terrorizing the citizens and the local community folk of Falk, Arkansas. And this went on in the 1970s. And the story revolved around a family called the Crabtree family, Smokey Crabtree in particular, and his encounters and the family's encounters with this creature. And being 10 years old, you're very susceptible to monsters, myths, and legends and all that stuff. And I was just drawn to it. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And another one of these movies that were played several weeks later was called Creature from the Black Lake. And it was filmed in Caddo, Texas, not far from the Louisiana border, Falk, Arkansas area.
Uh-huh.
And again, the same premise, an upright, hairy, hominid type of creature terrorizing the local town folk. And that just really fascinated me. I thought, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. So I went to the library to see if I could find any books on the subject. And I didn't find a book on Boggy Creek, but I did find John Green's Apes Among Us, Sasquatch Apes Among Us. And I began to read that, and I was stunned to read about all these sightings that took place all over the country. And I was even more shocked and surprised to see that there were actual sightings going on in Pennsylvania, my home state, and in Greensburg, my hometown. I was stunned. And from there, I just started reading more and more. I would go to the library and pick up another book, and I'd find another book. And pretty soon, I was getting my hands on everything I could read. And I was so enthralled with the possibility of a creature like I saw in these movies, running around the woods around my home. And I started doing some newspaper research and found out, sure enough, there were actual sighting reports in Pennsylvania in the 1970s. And matter of fact, some of them just mere miles from where I lived and grew up. And it was just enthralling to me as a young kid. And I thought, man, maybe these things really are out there. So anything I could get my hands on from newspaper reports, magazine articles, Reader's Digest, Life Magazine, Argosy, anything I could get my hands on to learn about these creatures, I did. And I read a ton of books, anything I could find, not just at our public library, but at my junior high school and high school libraries. Anytime we went out of town, I would go to their library and check there. And of course, followed up to the newspaper articles. And whenever we'd have a news segment come on about the Bigfoot creature being reported, I would be all over the TV watching it and trying to learn as much as I could. Of course,
cool.
The classic staple of the In Search Of shows with Leonard Factor. But one thing that really got me off the ground as far as getting into research was there was a local investigator who's now, I call him my mentor. His name was Stan Gordon. And Stan is not only a cryptid investigator or an investigator of unusual animals, but he's also an investigator of UFO sightings and other strange phenomena. And he began his research back in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And Stan would hold these, it was really kind of cool. At the local mall, he would hold these displays, and he put up pictures and artifacts and magazine articles and anything he could find on UFOs, ghosts, hauntings, and, of course, Bigfoot. And I would beg my parents, please, you got to take me to the mall. You let me spend the weekend at the mall just checking this stuff out. And that's what I did. He would hold these events once a year, and year after year, I would spend my entire weekend at the mall just reviewing this material, looking over it, asking questions. And what was really cool is, and I'm sure you could probably relate to this, when you're a kid, and especially if you have an interest in a subject or somebody you look up to, and you try to ask them questions, you're always afraid they're going to not talk to you. They're going to shoo you away. Get away from me, kid. You're bothering me.
Right.
But Stan was actually the opposite. He always took the time out to talk to me, to answer my questions, even as odd as and crazy as they were. He always took the time to spend 5, 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was, talking to me about his research and the Bigfoot creature and the other phenomenon. So I just kept going to these displays every year, and really got hot and heavily involved in educating myself on the subject. I wanted to know as much as I could about it and learn as much as I could from not only Stan, but from the books and the newspaper articles, magazine articles, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And that led up to my 27th birthday. I had gotten hired to move out to Kent, Ohio. I got hired by Enterprise Rent-A-Car just a few years out of college, and moved over to Kent, Ohio. And while I was over there, I was on the Internet, brand new to the Internet, and one day I found a website, the Eastern Ohio Bigfoot Investigation Center, and I saw they were holding a Bigfoot conference. And I thought, that has to be the coolest thing in the world to see a Bigfoot conference.
Yeah.
So, I made plans and went down and attended the conference, and I met a lot of folks who were out there legitimately investigating, researching, following up these sighting reports of these Bigfoot-type creatures. And I met a gentleman by the name of Don Keating, who was the chairman and the host of the event, and I talked to him for a good maybe half an hour, 45 minutes about my interest in the subject. And he said to me, you know, Stan investigates in Pennsylvania, and there's another gentleman by the name of Paul Johnson who investigates in Pennsylvania, but they really don't have many folks over there investigating. Why don't you get out in the field and do it? It's not hard to do. So I took what he said to heart and came back to Pennsylvania about a year later and started researching and joined the Bigfoot Field Research Organization. They're a nationally known organization, and I was instantly made the point of contact for Pennsylvania, which kind of surprised me. And,
well, I'm sure there's probably not a zillion people, you know, beating a path.
Well, at that time, it was kind of surprising because I thought that, too. I only thought, you know, there was a couple researchers. But when they made me the point of contact for Pennsylvania, they asked me to set up a network of other fellow investigators, and they emailed me a list of about 50
wow.
people in Pennsylvania who were interested in getting out and doing field research. So I got on the phone and started contacting these folks, you know, talking to them about their interests, and
mm-hmm.
We had a lot in common and shared a lot of the same interests. And pretty soon I put together a nice little investigative team, a network team, that if something came up in their area and I got the report from the BFRO, I would forward it on to them and get them out in the field. And I made a lot of contacts that way. Here I was not even a year into investigating, and I was networking and learning about, you know, the research field and what was all entailed.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, my stint with the BFR was short-lived, and I decided to start doing things independently. And I met up with two gentlemen named Steve Anderson and Henry Benton, and they were in the process of putting together a Bigfoot group in Pennsylvania called the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society. And what they wanted to do was basically put together a poor man's Bigfoot group, like a club, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Those who were just interested, and you know, we could sit around on Friday nights and talk on the phone about Bigfoot, or, you know, get together for a cup of coffee and discuss Bigfoot, you know, what we thought about it and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And it kind of snowballed. It kept getting bigger and bigger, and we got more and more people involved, and the people who were my contacts and the BFRO were interested in getting involved. And before you know it, the PBS had 10, 15 members, and then 25, 30 members, and we were growing. And we were pretty excited. We were getting out in the field about once a week.
Wow.
And we didn't have a lot of sighting reports coming in at that time because we were new.
Uh-huh.
We were just getting a website up and running. And what we decided to do at that time to get our feet wet in the investigative field was to go out and investigate locations where there had been sightings in the past, just to look at the terrain, get an idea of what kind of habitat was out there, familiarize ourselves with the flora and fauna, the food sources, the waterways, to see what kind of wildlife was in the area, and maybe just the chance of finding a Bigfoot track or some evidence
mm-hmm.
that might have been out there. And we did that for the first about a year or so, and it was in early, I guess late 1999, early 2000, Steve called me up and said, "Hey, buddy, I'm going to be leaving the group. I have some personal issues that I need to tend to, and I really hate to break this thing up because we've got a nice little group of people here that are interested in the subject, and I'm passing the baton on to you."
Cool.
And I was kind of surprised. I was like, sure, but I really don't know anything about running a Bigfoot group, and I don't think I'm qualified for it. And he said, basically, Eric, you got two choices, pal. You can either take the baton and run with it and do the best you can, or we're not going to have a Bigfoot group because I just can't do it. and I've been trapped ever since.
So how's it going now, man? Have you learned a thing or two?
I've learned a lot, actually. I've learned a lot since 2000. It's been quite an adventure. Not only learning about organizing and running a group, we've had literally hundreds of people in and out of the door of the PBS. They come in for a while, they stay with the group for a few years, they investigate, and then they feel it's time to move on to do their own
mm-hmm.
thing, so they move on.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned a lot about the community and the Bigfoot community itself over the years, the good and bad. I've learned a lot about field investigating, and what's really interesting is our group really never had anybody to teach us the proper methods and procedures of investigating. We just kind of went out there and did a trial and error type of thing.
Uh-huh.
We go out and try to follow up on reports the best we could and using common sense and logic, and we kind of learned and developed our own processes and methods and procedures over the years. And it's been an exciting 8 years running the group.
Sounds like a good growth opportunity on a lot of levels.
Yeah, it was. It taught me a lot about myself as far as what I was capable of doing and gaining a lot of leadership skills. And I've learned a lot about people over the years as well, from interacting with a variety of people from different backgrounds and different social backgrounds and whatnot. And not only in our group, but in the Bigfoot community, the paranormal community in general, I've had the fortunate pleasure of being able to network with hundreds of people in the paranormal community through our Bigfoot group and being involved in other paranormal conferences, and I meet new people all the time. So I treasure that more than anything else. It's just the opportunity to network and get to know people and
mm-hmm.
share the information.
Well, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated about your bio is that you stated that you learned so much from books. And, you know, and I just want to underscore that. I want to say to the folks listening, and I'm sure they have too, but don't underestimate the value of books and documentaries and just plunging yourself into the knowledge as it's related in those different media, because you can learn an awful lot. I mean, like you, Eric, I've done the same thing for decades. You know, I've read all, I mean, and of course, like you, my interests pour over to everything, you know, everything paranormal, UFOs, Bigfoot, hauntings, parapsychology, the whole thing. You know, I'm just interested in all of it. And it's amazing how much you can learn and grow and educate yourself. I love the quote by Jim Rohn, a pretty well-known motivational speaker. He said that college education will earn you a living. Self-education will make you millions, you know. So in other words, self-education, nothing to be poo-pooed at. You know, it's a valuable part of our growth. So I commend you for that, you know, and those listening to never underestimate the power of self-education. That's where it's at. Plus, you combine that with the experience like you've had. You were talking about some of your processes, and you were learning those by trial and error. And now, have you kind of honed those so you've learned the best approaches and things?
Yeah, we're still learning. There's still a lot of
questions
to be answered, and I consider myself a student of the subject. I'm always going to be learning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always welcome and open to new ideas, suggestions, comments, thoughts, thinking outside the box, mm-hmm. trying new things. Because after 50 years of investigations into the Sasquatch phenomenon, we're a little closer to solving it, but you know, we really haven't gained a lot of ground. We're still in the infancy of it, basically, and we're still learning. So I always keep my mind open, and I try to learn as much as I can, but at the same time, trying to learn logically and using common sense when doing it.
Yeah, and see, that's such an incredibly healthy attitude, and I just want to tell our listeners, too, that very attitude that you have displayed is exactly why we invited you to be a consultant with Paranexus in the area of Bigfoot and related cryptozoology, you know, and of course, you've accepted that, and I just want to really commend you for that, because that's exactly what Paranexus is all about. Fresh thinking, Think for yourself. Be open-minded. Don't go down a particular preconceived path. You know, be open to the possibilities, which we'll get into, especially as it relates to Bigfoot. There are a couple of questions, though, in the chat room, as I'm sure you read, from Hunter Gather. Sharon, are there sightings in every state of the U.S., or is it concentrated into areas or specific areas?
Every state in the United States has had a sighting report, with the exception of Hawaii. But Hawaii has legends of a bipedal creature. It's not necessarily a Bigfoot type of creature, but they do have legends of a bipedal type entity in their folklore. But there have been sighting reports in every 49 of their 50 states, and it's concentrated to specific areas, but it isn't bound to those specific areas, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Each state has had its own number of reports and sightings, and it may be due to a variety of factors, either migration or food sources. We're really not certain at this point. There are a lot of theories on that. But, yes, every state has had a sighting, at least one sighting reported in it. It used to be thought by a lot of researchers that I believe it was New Hampshire and Hawaii were the two states that didn't have any sightings, but since that has changed. We tend to find a lot of the activity is being reported out of the Pacific Northwest, of course, Northern
sure.
California, Oregon, Washington, even up into British Columbia. However, the eastern United States is just as active, and that's quite a misnomer. People think, eastern United States, how is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got some, basically the whole country, there's still a lot of area in this country that's unexplored, and
mm-hmm.
A lot of folks haven't been in. Either we've had explored them, and they're just not populated. You know, there's still a lot of wild area left in this
mm-hmm.
country. Even Florida has the legends of the skunk ape.
Oh, yeah. Tons of them.
Yeah. It's not privy to one specific area. It's a nationwide phenomenon and a worldwide phenomenon, if you actually think about it.
So I'm guessing Hawaii is the state that with no reports.
Well, none that I'm aware of, and like I said, I've been doing this for a while, and I have not read of anything. I have read of some folklore and legends of a bipedal type entity, but I don't believe that it matches the descriptions of Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there's another question from Mike Tesla, which is a good question, something I'd like to get into as well. From the research in the field, have you and others come to the conclusion that Bigfoot is actually an unknown form of great ape?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on that. Unfortunately, at this point, we haven't been able to draw a specific conclusion as to exactly what Bigfoot is or what it might be related to. There are reports that talk about the creature looking more human-like than a primate, and on the other side of the coin, there are reports talking this animal is more primate-looking than human. We really don't know yet until we were able to capture a specimen or bring a body into study at what exactly this animal is.
What are the possibilities?
I don't know. To be perfectly honest, I don't know if it is related to human or not. There's a lot of folks seeing this thing that, you know, hunters, fishermen, outdoorsmen, common folk from the city that see these things that describe it as looking very much like a human, and it's very possible that this could be a relative of human or a distant relative of human. We're not certain. Until we were able to get that body in there and study mm-hmm. it, or even like Jane Goodall or Diane Fossey is able to study the mountain gorillas. You know, we're not going to be able to make a definitive answer on that.
Sure. Well, obviously, one hypothesis is that it is a relative of humanity. And another hypothesis is that it's simply a form of great ape.
Right.
Another hypothesis is that it is somehow interdimensional.
Yes, that's another one, too.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you look at some of the evidence. I mean, if you look at some of these different theories, each one seems to have its pros and cons, I would think. For example, the skeptics, you know, the old skeptics thing, you know, if there are so many of them, where are they? You know, why haven't we found bones? What's your reply to that?
Well, there's a number of things that I answer when asked that question. That's a great question that you get asked quite a bit in our studies. The most common answer that I give to that is Mother Nature has a phenomenal recycling source. You know, an animal dies in the wilderness, it's devoured and it decays and it's pretty much gone within a week's time. Small rodents,
right.
Insects.
They're related.
Yeah. You know, things like that. Porcupines eat the bones of animals. And not only in a situation like that, but it's very rare, and it's not saying it doesn't happen, but it's very rare that we find common species that have died in the wilderness without being shot or you know, shot with an arrow or a gun. If we do find bear remains, it's not common. And the same with deer. It's not common that we find them if they die from natural causes. There are cases where they are found, but it's just a piece of a bone. And a lot of folks that are involved in the Bigfoot research, or a lot of folks that are just out there in general hiking in the woods, find these bones or come across these bones, and they're not scientists. They're not educated to what type of bone they are. So most of them rationally think, oh, it's just a bear or just, you know, deer.
Mm-hmm.
And they write off as that and leave them there. I'm sure there's been many cases where there's been folks in the woods, you know, hiking or camping or whatever, and they find bones, and they could actually be something, and they just decide, you know, oh, it's just bear, and they leave it as such. And there's also other theories out there that these creatures, you know, go to a Bigfoot graveyard, much like an elephant graveyard. They go off somewhere in the deep remote wilderness and to die. Or there are theories out there, as crazy as it sounds, that Bigfoot is intelligent enough to bury their dead. They have a social network like humans do. They bury their dead. So there's a number of reasons why we haven't found a body yet. I think if we had investigators who had the time and the money and the manpower to do it, to spend the time in the woods that's necessary to get this mystery solved, we may come back with some better physical evidence than we've already collected.
Makes sense. And there's a couple of questions. Hunter-gatherer, could it have been a DNA experiment gone wrong, perhaps adding to another hypothesis? Has there been any speculation that way?
I don't think it's a DNA experiment gone wrong, because these creatures have been around for hundreds of years. They're they're very common in Native American or First American folklore and mythology. A lot of these tribes have names for these creatures. They're familiar with these creatures. To them, it's not a myth. It's not a legend. These are actual animals, you know, that they have been familiar with for hundreds of years. So I don't think it's a DNA experiment gone wrong. We've just started to become involved in DNA study in the last 10, 15 years. So I don't believe it's anything to do with DNA.
And then Mike is talking about recently Spain gave mountain gorillas human rights, which is news to me. I didn't realize that. He asked, do you think that if they do find out it's related to us, they will be protected?
Yeah, I do believe that there will be some kind of protection, and that's the goal of a lot of groups out there, is to get these animals protected, either under the Endangered Species Act, or if they are found to be close to humans, there would definitely be some legislation put on the books, I feel, to...
Or should be, anyway.
There should be. And there are two places in the United States that do have laws to protect these animals. And Skamania County up in Washington has a law in the books that was put back in, I believe it was in the early 1970s. I can't think of the exact, late 1960s, early 1970s. I can't think of the exact year. But there is a law in the books to protect these creatures from being shot. There's It used to be a federal, not a federal offense, but not a misdemeanor like it is now, but it was a pretty hefty fine and some prison time involved with it, and I believe they just made it a misdemeanor now. And over in Whitehall, New York, there's a law in the books to protect these Bigfoot creatures. So there are some places in the United States that are actually protecting these animals. But unfortunately, until we are able to get science to look at them and, you know, take the study seriously, we're basically spinning our wheels to try to get these things protected.
Well, on your website, you talk about your group has a no-kill policy. So, well, that's great for one thing. But secondly, I guess that then begs the question, are there groups out there who believe otherwise, that they want to kill one and bring it in?
Yeah, there are some groups who are advocates of killing one of these animals to protect and preserve the species. I think that's what it's going to take, is to bring a body in or part of a body in to examine, study, to cross-reference blood and DNA, you know, the things that we've already collected to see if those match. We are going to have to study one of these, and then, of course, studying these animals in their own natural habitat in the wild is going to have to be done so we can learn more about them. But there are groups out there who actively go out with the intention of killing these animals. They put on drives and hunts to try to collect a specimen.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, Reverend Strone in the chat room has a good question. Do you think some of the differences in descriptions could be in some part attributed to the varying impressions, experiences, and interpretations of the individual witnesses?
Let me first say hi to Daniel. Daniel's a friend of mine. Hey, Daniel, how you doing? Down in New Zealand.
Oh, cool. Hey, Daniel.
Yeah, he's a graphic artist and a very good one. He does some excellent cryptozoological artwork that
cool.
I've seen over the past couple of months. But to answer his question, yes, I think a lot of that has to ties into the sighting reports. It's open interpretation. Some folks see red eye shine when they see
mm-hmm.
creatures. Some folks don't. Some folks describe these creatures as having very human-like features, especially in the face. That's why a lot of hunters have refused to shoot it. They've had it in their scope or their
mm-hmm.
sight. Refused to shoot it because they said the face looks too human. I think a lot of it is interpretation, and it very well could be. I have not seen one, so I can't really say, what my experiences would be versus what other folks are saying. But I can say that over the years, a lot of the sighting reports that we've collected, we do find commonalities and a lot of common threads in the reports. But there are sometimes varying factors in those reports, from eye shine, from smells, from human versus ape-like features. And I think that could very well be from interpretation. It could be from the human psyche. They're seeing something they've never seen before, and their mind is trying to rationalize what they're
mm-hmm.
seeing. But they're trying to relate it to something they know. Maybe they're thinking this thing is actually a person in a costume, so they're trying to rationalize that, and that might be what they're seeing. I honestly don't know.
Do you think that the reports where their eyes are red or emitting a red light or something like that, do you think that could just simply be reflected light like some animals?
Yeah. Yeah, I know you had Jason Valenti on your program back in May, and I know Jason, real good guy, and
uh-huh.
he talks about the self-luminescent glow
mm-hmm.
they give off and how they're related to humans have those same qualities in our eyes as well. I think a lot of that is just light reflection or refraction. I don't think they're self-luminescent.
Right.
I really haven't done a lot of study on that to really determine if that's the case. I'm more interested in the sighting reports from the witnesses, but I don't personally think that they're self-luminescent. I think they give off a glow.
Well, if their eyes give off a glow, to my knowledge, they would be the first mammal known to do that.
Right, exactly.
I mean, there's some fish who are, luminescent, give off that. But I
tend to think, though, that it's due to light shining on them,
mm-hmm.
whether it be a spotlight, a car light, some outside
mm-hmm.
light source is reflecting off of their eyes, because we see that happen with all common wildlife.
Right.
Cats, dogs,
deer,
raccoon,
mm-hmm.
bear, we
Definitely.
See eye shining quite a bit. So I don't have an answer for those ones. The folks see that they do describe the red glowing eyes without the light source to it. I have no answer for that. I can't
mm.
really say what's causing that.
Interesting. So you haven't seen one before, right?
What's that?
You have not ever seen one.
No, I've had a few experiences over my tenure in Bigfoot research where I believe I've been close to these animals on more than one occasion.
Well, let's talk about that. Okay, what have been some of your experiences?
Well, I've heard some things while I've been out in the woods investigating that I can't explain. I've been an outdoorsman for a number of years, going on maybe 15, 20 years. I've been an outdoorsman, hunting, fishing, camping, hiking, the whole gamut.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't consider myself an expert on wildlife, but I would consider myself familiar with the sounds of common animals. I've heard some screams, and I've heard some guttural growls that I just cannot explain. I have no idea what they were, and even thinking back on some of these sounds I've heard just gives me goosebumps. Some have been so loud and so piercing that I can't, in my own mind, rationalize what kind of animal would be able to make that kind of sound. I've had those types of experiences. I also had a really interesting experience back in 2000 in northeastern Pennsylvania, a little county called Bradford County. We had a gentleman by the name of Dave contact our group just as we were starting out, and he told us some interesting stories about him going out into the state game lands he lived near and having numerous encounters, including sightings of these creatures. And this was going on for quite some time, so I got together a small research group from my area and where he lived, and we went up there and we spent a couple weekends staying out on the game lands and hiking and checking them out. And one in particular Saturday, myself and a small group of the guys that went up there went into this game land area, and we decided, let's split up. Myself and my research partner at the time, his name was John, we decided to hike a trail that David told us he had had some experiences on, bush shaking and hearing some heavy footfalls and branches breaking, that sort of thing. So John and I decided to walk up this trail, and as we were walking up this trail, from our right behind us down the hill, we heard what sounded like, to me, something picking up a piece of wood and whacking it against another tree, another piece of wood, very loud, almost very reminiscent of the sound of if you're at a baseball game and a hitter hits a home run, that knock, as soon as he hits that ball, you know it's a home run.
Right.
Very distinctive sound. We heard two of those, and we thought, okay, well, maybe it's guys in our group that are pulling some kind of stunt on us or down the bottom of the hill making noise. So I radioed down to them, and they said, no, we're nowhere near you guys. We're down the creek looking at some possible footprints down here. So we said, okay. We thought that was kind of interesting. And as you and I know, the only type of animal that I'm aware of that would be able to hold a piece of wood in its hand and strike it against a tree would have to be something with an opposable thumb.
Right.
Which is either a person or...
presumably.
Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we thought it was kind of unusual hearing that, and we continued up the hill, walking along this trail, and as we were walking, we began to hear very heavy movement through the brush, heavy footfalls, something very large moving through the brush, breaking branches, trampling bushes, and it was moving to our right, coming up behind us very quickly, and it moved up onto a ravine to our right, and it was about our 3 o'clock position, and we were facing forward. And we both stopped, and we turned to that 3 o'clock position. We're looking up in the ravine, and we couldn't see anything. Now, this is in August of 2000. Very, very thick, heavy foliage. You can see more than 5 feet off the trail.
Moonlight, or?
This was during the day.
Oh, during the day, okay.
About 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
A little bit after 1 o'clock. And we were standing there looking at each other, and I had my little video camera with me, and I'm filming it, and we're whispering to one another, what could that be? And John says, I don't know, but it's either a bear, a person, or something large. And as we were standing there, this thing began to move again. And as it was walking, you could see the tops of the trees as it was walking by moving. They were shaking as this thing was walking by. And it flushed out a tree of blue jays. And when it did that, the blue jays took off. The whole woods just became instantly silent.
Hmm.
You couldn't hear birds chirping, bugs making any noise. It was like someone clipped the light switch.
Hmm.
And we both kind of looked at each other, and that's another common trait when these creatures are around. All the animals and insects go quiet. So we're looking at each other, and we're kind of puzzled what the sound is, or what the sound went, I should say, and what this animal is that's moving through the trees. We were watching the wake of the trees as this thing moved. We could see the tops of the trees shaking, and it was continuing down to our, now at our 12 o'clock as we were looking right at it. It was moving to our 11 o'clock, then 10, then 9, etc., moving to our left counter clockwise. And it eventually crossed over the trail in front of us, way out of our line of sight. And it continued down and almost doubled back around behind us. And it was now in a ravine to our 6 o'clock position if we were facing where we first heard it.
So your rear.
Yeah, exactly. It was behind us. And John and I turned around. And while we were standing there looking at each other, whispering to each other, trying to figure out what this was, we could hear it begin to make these noises. And the only way to really describe the noises that it was making was if you've ever attempted as a kid stuffing your mouth as full as much as you could and then trying to talk.
Mm-hmm.
make these uncomprehensible sounds, this kind of like mumbling and funky kind of sound. And that's what this was doing. It was a very guttural sound, too, a low guttural sound, but very unintelligible. We didn't understand what the thing was saying. And it was growling, and my buddy John said, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go see what this is. And no sooner did he say that, he stepped off the trail into the brush to approach this thing. This thing took off running clockwise, the same way it came, and it was so fast, we turned almost 180 degrees following this thing within a matter of a second and a half.
Wow.
That's how quick this thing ran back counter or clockwise around us. Back down the hill, the same direction it came, we could see the wake moving, the trees. We could hear it going through the brush, and within a matter of 5 seconds, it was gone from ears shot. We couldn't hear it anymore.
So what's your speculation? What was it?
I have no idea. I know as far as I'm experienced with, a person couldn't have covered that much ground that quickly. We radioed down to the group again, and we were like, guys, we just experienced something up here. We don't know what it was. You got to get up here. Where are you? And we're still down at the creek. Well, this thing's coming right your way. And they started moving towards the trail, and, of course, they never saw what it was. They never heard it. But to be perfectly honest with you, I have no idea what it was. It was a very large animal, a very fast animal, and at times it sounded like it was trying to communicate with us, but it was very difficult to understand because it had, as I was explaining, a mouthful of something it sounded like.
Well, there are some reports. I forget the lady. I saw this on a documentary where these things can communicate, at least very elementarily, that's not even a word, in a very elementary way. I don't know if you ever saw it. I don't recall her name, and I forget where it was, but I think it was in the southeast. But, I mean, the thing would come to her door and ask for things, but, you know, using only very one-word sentences, you know. Have you ever heard of that, any of these reports where they've actually communicated?
You're referring to the Janice Carter Coy incident where she was.
You're good, you. You're good,
and,
you.
and the
creature, at least I was right about the southeast.
Yeah. The creature came. Apparently, the creature that she calls Fox came to her door and asked for garlic.
Right.
I. That's the only case that I'm aware of, or the only situation that I'm aware of where a creature has actually communicated with a person in an intelligible language. Now, there are the Bigfoot sound recordings made by Ron Moorhead and Alan Berry from the Sierra Mountains of California in the early 1970s, 73, 74, where they've recorded something, and at times it does sound like it almost has a language, but what kind of language it is, I don't know. There's two of those recordings available, and Robert W. Morgan was on another talk show in the late 1990s, where he analyzed this tape, and he claims that he had actually picked out a portion of the language that the creature said, "You're not welcome." And it's very possible. At this point, anything is possible in this field because we don't have the answers. But I've never heard a creature communicate with me. And again, what we experienced out there in the woods that day, I can't say it was a Bigfoot because I didn't see it. But it was something large and very fast. And it shook me up pretty bad. I wanted to go right back to the truck and just stay at the truck for the rest of the afternoon because I've never experienced anything like that before.
So now you're talking to me as a researcher, and that's fine, and that's exactly what you should say. Let me ask you these questions.
Mm-hmm.
Could that animal that you saw in the woods, what could it have been? I mean, if not a Bigfoot, what could it have been?
I don't know.
I mean, where were you at again? I'm sorry.
I don't know.
No, where was this at? What location?
Oh, Bradford County, northern Pennsylvania.
Okay, and it's wooded. Are there bears there?
Yes.
Okay, brown bears.
And I tried to logically. Yeah, there are black bears and brown bears in that area. Yes, and I tried to logically think to myself that evening, what could we have experienced? What would have caused the wood knocking sound that we heard? And I thought about it, and I said, the only rational conclusion that I could think of would be a person or a Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
That's the the only two answers I could conclusively come up with, because I've never heard of any encounters with a bear picking up a piece of wood and knocking it off a tree, or any other animal doing that, a common animal to that area. So, rationally in my own mind, I was thinking there's only two possible answers. It was either a bear, or not a bear, excuse me, a human, or a Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I could rationalize. And something that fast, I know bears are pretty quick. I've never been chased by one, but I've had a couple experiences with bears, and I know they're pretty quick animals. I know deer are lightning fast.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen hundreds of deer in the woods, and they are lightning fast. But for this thing to circle us and then to take the same route back it went, or it originally came, and some of the characteristics, I don't know what it could have been. I really don't.
What color was it again?
I didn't see it.
Oh, you didn't see it. You just saw the wake.
The wake.
Of
the trees,
okay.
Brush,
and
moving, was, stuff like that. But
was there any estimation of height?
No.
Okay. And was there any smell?
No, there was no smell.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The question in the chat room, did you find any footprints in that area?
There were footprints found at the creek bed by the other part of the group that were investigating, and I did go down and look at them. They weren't, in my opinion, they weren't bare human prints.
Mm-hmm.
You can see toes and a ball of the foot.
Mm-hmm.
They were very large impressions. They were older prints, as I call them, because we didn't see the animal that made them, and they were very long, human-like, human-shaped prints in the ground.
Human size?
Much bigger. I think we measured about 14 to 15 inches long.
Well, wouldn't that be, how many toes do Bigfoots have? I mean, I've seen several variations on toes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been reports of 3 toes, 4 toes, and even 5 toes. 5 toes is the more common tracks that have been found. But there were these prints that we found, they were older, they were weathered, and they just looked like oblong foot-shaped impressions in the ground. We couldn't see any defined toes. We couldn't see the ball.
I see.
So we really couldn't rationalize if they were definitely Bigfoot tracks or not. They were very large impressions, which incidentally is the case on a lot of things, a lot of investigations that we find. The ground in Pennsylvania is not real inducive to tracks like you find in the Pacific Northwest, where you have a sandy type of soil. Here it's more of a bituminous coal.
Topsoil. Oh, okay.
Very hard shale in the ground. It's a very hard soil. So we will have a lot of moisture in the ground that's more conducive to tracks.
Well, Blue Tracker in the chat room wants to know, was there any branches broken or trail sign marks?
We did find, the next day we went back up and we did a real thorough search of the area with the group. And we did find some broken branches, but they were about 4 or 5 feet off the ground. We really weren't sure if it was a bear going through, it could have done that. There wasn't anything real up high that we found. We did find a lot of tree markers, or as Bigfoot researchers call them, trail markers, trail signs, things that were built up against a base of a tree, or branches leaned against the base of a tree, almost in a teepee-type formation. We did see several of those, and at that time, back in 2000, this wasn't a common thing in the Bigfoot community. The teepee structures and the trail marker structures weren't talked about. Matter of fact, we were just in the process of finding these, and the discussion was just brand new back then. So we did see these, but we really weren't certain what they were, and we didn't know if there was a common thread between those and Bigfoot sighting reports. But
have you seen those since?
Oh, yeah. We see them quite regularly around sighting locations. But personally, I don't count them as Bigfoot sign because, as far as I'm aware of, no one's ever seen a Bigfoot doing these. The trail markers are simply speculation at this point.
What could have done them?
Hunters, hikers, possibly a Bigfoot. It's very possible Bigfoot did do it, but
well, then
not
there's
seeing
motive.
The animal do it, it's speculation.
Sure. So then you have to examine motive. Okay, if it's hunters, hikers doing it, what's the motivation? Why would they be marking a trail, in your opinion?
A good place to hunt.
Or
to leave a sign that they're familiar with, to come back to the area to hunt. Or
sure.
Hikers on a trail kind of marking their way, so they don't get lost. They
okay.
Lay a couple branches there so, to point them to let them know they're coming back in the right direction. That's a possibility. We didn't see anybody up on that game lands that day while we were up there. And from what David told us, you know, people do go hunt up there and they fish up in that area, but it's not a widely used game land. So I have really no explanation as to what the trail markers were from.
Well, another anomaly or a piece of evidence that's been associated with Bigfoot is trees broken off at a 8 or 10 foot height,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes. Yeah,
and
that's also a commonality as well as the tree twists or the branch twists. There are cases where folks find tree twists, and again, the only thing that really can make these tree twists are animals or people who have that opposable thumb.
So were you able to see anything like that on that?
No, we didn't see any tree twists while we were up there.
Okay. Is that what you call it, the tree twists when they break them off the tree?
We call them tree twists when they break the branch, but they don't break it completely off. They kind of
right.
twist it like you would twist a wash rag.
Right.
Okay. Like that.
Okay. Another phenomena that's been associated with Bigfoot is throwing of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever experienced anything like that?
Yes. I've had rocks thrown at me on several occasions. One in 2004, we were investigating an area where there had been a sighting about 6 months prior, and a group of us were out, and we were walking on a gas line, and this is in Clearfield County in the center part of the state, very remote area, and while we were walking on this gas line, one of our female members of the group decided she wanted to take a break, and she sat down while we were exploring the local woods around her, and she called out to the group and said she had heard heavy footfalls in an area behind her. She heard three distinct heavy thumps.
Mm-hmm.
Footfall.
Mm-hmm.
And when she notified us of this, three or four members of our investigative team went directly into those woods. And I, in turn, went back down the gas line towards the main road in case this animal doubled back. I might be able to catch it running away from her. And as I was standing in the gas line, maybe about 150 to 200 yards away from them, I had heard right in the wood line, maybe 50 yards in, I heard a very loud branch break, which indicated to me that something large was in there moving
mm-hmm.
that brush. And I was stopped, and I was listening for any kind of movement, any type of noise or anything, and I motioned to the guys to come down to where I was at, and they all quickly moved down to where I was standing, and I pointed into the woods, and I said, right in there, I heard about 50 yards in a very large, loud branch break. We were all kind of looking in and slowly moving into the woods quietly as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were moving in, to our left, behind us, a tree got pushed over.
How big? A big one or small one?
It was a pretty big tree. It came crashing down. It was a good maybe 7,500 yards to our 7 o'clock position, 8 o'clock position to our left behind us. And our attention turned to the loud noise of the tree falling over. And we were scanning the woods looking for any movement. And while our back was turned to where we heard the branch break, out from that area come a baseball-sized rock through the trees. It missed us by maybe 2 or 3 feet, come ripping through the tree. You could hear it. I turned around and heard it thump on the ground, and I saw it laying there, and I said, did anybody in our group throw that? And everybody was accounted for. There was nobody behind me. So I have no explanation where that rock came from, and there was no one else up there in the woods that day. So
yeah, well, I mean, okay. So what we're going with here, I mean, what we've got is a lot of circumstantial evidence, correct?
Right.
Empirical evidence that's not necessarily, I mean, you didn't see it, you didn't bag it, you didn't photograph it, you didn't touch it, et cetera, but you've got some circumstantial evidence that is very compelling, it sounds to me.
And that's why I'm very careful about, you know, saying these things are Bigfoot related, a Bigfoot did it, or Bigfoot was responsible for it. I mean, in my mind and in my heart, I want to believe that a Bigfoot did do this. But without me physically seeing the creature do these things, I can only speculate what did. And it's all circumstantial evidence. And a lot of it does fall in line with a lot of the witness sighting reports and what a lot of other researchers encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see it for myself. You know, I didn't see the creature myself. And I only heard the noises. I only experienced the animal running around us. I experienced the rock coming from behind us, the tree falling over. I heard that. I have no answers as to what did it. And a lot of folks say, well, common sense says you go through the possibilities and you rule them out, and you're left with Bigfoot doing it. Well, I can't say that because I didn't see the Bigfoot do it.
Mm-hmm.
I can only say I don't know what did it, because I honestly don't. There was something there those days that I experienced those things that caused those things to happen, and there's circumstantial evidence, and yes, they do fall in line with a lot of other reports and what other researchers experience, but until I am able to see one of these animals myself do these things, I have to say that, you know, I don't know what did it.
Okay, good. Well, fair enough. We're coming up at the top of the hour here, and we're going to take a break in just a few minutes. Again, thanks so much to those of our listeners in the chat room who are coming up with some great questions, and there's still a couple left that I'll throw at Eric here in the next segment. I do want to mention that if you are not a member of Paranexus, we'd love to have you join us at paranexus.org. It's a newer site, a few months old. Paranexus is a professional association of paranormal researchers that includes parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, paranormal researchers. We really are trying to bring people together to share evidence, to share tips, to really just share and network and work together on a common theme, because there's some folks who believe that there's some of these different things, not all, but some are perhaps related, and we're trying to understand what it means. In fact, I would have always said that the reason we all do this is to better understand the human condition, you know, and our world around us. So we'd love to have you be a part of it. Go to paranexus.org and take a look at it. Another thing that we just launched today that I'd like to announce, I did announce it in the newsletter, is a new website that's a division of Paranexus, which is called parazonetv.com. There is a link on paranexus.org. And it's really a YouTube-type site where you can share videos. It's a little bit looser than the Paranexus forum, where we really focus on some pretty substantial evidence. But you can upload videos and audios and pictures and different things. You can network and share. It's all paranormally related. We'd love to have you go there. It's a free site, and upload some videos and add some content. And the same goes for Paranexus. If you are a member, join us and upload some of your pictures, and if you've got questions, is this an anomaly or whatever, put it in there. Let's get some feedback, because we're all trying to answer the questions, and Paranexus is all about working together, so we'd love to have you be a part of that and share your knowledge, your experiences, your evidence with everybody as well. So that's just a wide-open invitation there. Now, we're going to take a break for just a few minutes. We'll be back, and we'll continue our discussion with Eric Altman. Eric, you want to talk about your website real quick, and we'll go to break? Tell everybody where it's at.
Sure. It's my website is www.pabigfootsociety.com, and you're welcome to check it out. We've got a pretty decent website with sighting reports. We're trying to keep as updated as we can. Sighting reports, some great links on it. Go check it out. It's a pretty good website, I think.
Yeah, it looks nice, man. You guys have a conference coming up in September. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's the 2008 East Coast Bigfoot Conference. It's the seventh one that we've put on. We've taken a little bit of a hiatus from 2005 to the present, but we're bringing it back this year. We've got a lineup of great guest speakers from the eastern United States to talk about their research and things that they've discovered in the field, and to educate the public on the subject. We've got displays of Bigfoot collected evidence, or possible Bigfoot collected evidence, I should say, track casts, photos, hair samples, stuff like that. We're going to have vendors selling Bigfoot-related items, T-shirts, novelty items, collectibles, that sort of thing. We have a large Bigfoot auction we put on every year. So it's a good time. It's a great opportunity for anybody that's interested in Bigfoot, especially here in the eastern United States, to come up and check it out. It's a great event for the family to come check out, and it's very affordable. We try to keep the prices economically affordable for the families to come up and check it out. It's a great way to get out there and learn about Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Good deal. That reminds me to talk about the Paranexus Conference coming up in October in Tampa. And we'd love to have you join us there, too. We've got some great speakers and great lineup, and should be another great opportunity to network with fellow researchers and learn and grow and share and all that. With that said, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and we'll continue our discussion with Eric Altman. Hang with us.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's Spirit Team with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for two full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Eric Altman from the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks. Glad to be here tonight.
Yeah, having a great discussion on things. So we've been talking about some of your experiences and some of your field research and expeditions and so forth. Have you had any other extraordinary experiences you'd like to share?
Well, a lot of what I deal with, I'm limited to the area I try. I've been all over the state, of course, and I try to keep one specific area that I research around close to where I live because it's economically smart, and I want to learn this area the best of my ability. But I have traveled quite extensively searching up this phenomenon, and I've heard things in the woods, like I explained earlier, that I don't know what made the noises or what caused the noises. I've talked to hundreds of witnesses, and I've investigated hundreds of cases, and there are some that really stand out that we've seen evidence, and we've seen things as a result that we have no explanation for. If folks want to go to our website, PABigfootSociety.com, and click on the photo section, there's some very interesting photos of a deer that was killed by something, and had its right front leg wedged into the Y of a small tree.
I saw that.
And from the collarbone or just below the esophagus back to its pelvis, and along the side of it was completely ripped out. Its right rear leg was ripped off, and unfortunately, due to the fact that those photos were pretty graphic, I had to leave them off the website. But the folks that found those, that found that deer, had quite an interesting story to go along with it, and I'll share that with you as quickly as I can.
You got time. Go ahead.
This occurred on the 4th of July back in 2006, actually 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they were returning home from a night out with the family, celebrating, and they live up in Wysox, Pennsylvania, a very, very remote area of northeastern Pennsylvania in Bradford County, might I add, where I had my experiences.
Mm.
And they pulled in the driveway, get out of their cars, and this is a little after 10:30 at night, a little late. They're walking towards their house, and they have a very wooded area behind their home, acres and acres of just woods. And as they're walking towards their house, they begin to hear these screams. And
Jesus.
Seeing that they live out there in the middle of nowhere, they're pretty familiar with common animals, and they've even heard cougars and mountain lions in the woods behind their home scream. And this is like nothing they ever heard before. Matter of fact, the father described to me in his report that screams were very much like the sounds that King Kong made in the movie when it roared. And they all walked around the back of their house and stood in their backyard looking at the woods, and they were hearing three different screams coming from three different locations.
Really?
Behind the house. And it was almost as if these animals or these things were communicating with each other. The screams would last about 15 seconds, and then a few seconds would go by, and then another would scream from another location. 15, 20 seconds, and then some moments of silence, and another response from another location. And this went on for a good 15 or 20 minutes before the family decided to go in the house. They were intrigued about what they heard, even to the point where the next day the kids of the family decided to go into the woods to see if they could find out what was making the screams the night before, find any evidence of what was back there. Well, they stumbled across this deer that was killed, and as I explained, it's right front leg was very tightly wedged into the Y of this small tree, and from its just below its esophagus to the back end of the deer was completely ripped open. Its right rear leg was missing. They found very large human-shaped impressions in the ground measuring 17 inches long.
Wow.
They found a rock on the ground that was, as they said, covered in blood. I've looked at the pictures. I don't see the blood on the rock, but apparently they did. And the head of the deer looked like something had blood. It was bludgeoned. Something beaten the deer over the head before it killed it. And there wasn't any sign on the tree of any claw marks from a cat or any other predator. They didn't find any gunshot wounds or any bows sticking out of it. It wasn't cut by a hunter. It was basically ripped apart. And that pretty much spooked the family. And they contacted us and filed the report about what they experienced and what they found in the woods. About a week later, after one of our investigators got a hold of them, took a trip up to the area, spent some time there, saw the deer. By the time he got there, the deer body was, as I explained, it was earlier, it was pretty much decomposed. All that was pretty much left was the skeletal remains, is what you see in the pictures, and it was covered in insects. And he looked at the deer by that time you could see the skull of the deer a lot more clear, and you could definitely see there are three what looks to be puncture holes in the skull of the deer. The deer looked like it hadn't been touched by any other animal, any other predator.
Mm.
The family had also mentioned that they had been back several times to know their animal had touched that deer, which is very unusual. But while our research crew was there, they looked at the impressions in the ground. They were shown those, and of course, a week had gone by. They were a little older and weathered. They had found these territorial markers, and I don't recall if I have these photos up on the website or not, but there were trees that were literally uprooted. They were small sapling trees, maybe 3, 4, 5 inches in diameter from the base going upward, but they were uprooted. They still had roots on all, and they were shoved in the Ys of other trees. A lot of branches broken, a lot of these thick formations that I mentioned earlier, these trail markers, and they were finding it all over the place. And later that night, the research group that went up there from our group decided to sit out in the woods and see if they could hear anything. And sure enough, they heard some distant screams. The family even agreed that it was very similar to what they heard on the 4th of July. About a year later, and they never did come to a conclusion as to what killed this deer, incidentally. They had some theories and possibilities, but they never came to a definitive conclusion.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, about a year later, the research group went back up to the area just to keep in touch with the witnesses and look at the animal again, and that carcass and the hide is still in the tree in the same position. It hasn't been removed.
Really?
Yeah, it's still there. And one of the members of our group is a wildlife biologist, and right now he's a park ranger at Yosemite National Park. And he was bound and determined to go up and get that carcass, bones and hide and everything, and take it to a forensic specialist in Virginia to have him study it. But unfortunately, at that time, we didn't have the funds to allocate that. So I don't know if he ever collected the animal remains from that or not, but... Yeah, back on 2007, around the same time, they went back up and looked, and that carcass was still in the tree. So it's a very intriguing case.
Janine, one of our Paranexus members and Spirit Team members, asked, has anyone ever heard deer scream? Very spooky. I guess that's news to me. I didn't realize deer scream. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, deer scream. They grunt. They snort.
That I know.
It'll spook you if you're not paying attention, or you know, you're out in the woods. It'll spook you, but it'll startle you. We were doing a night investigation back in May over in northeastern Ohio, and heard a buck snort, and it caught us all off guard. And all of it, I jumped off the table, expecting it. It startled me, but yeah, deer scream, especially when they're in distress or are panicked.
Sure. How's that different than a Bigfoot? Presume Bigfoot scream.
Bigfoot screams, as I've been following and studying and had reported to me, are very, very loud. You can tell they come from the lungs of a very large animal.
Uh-huh.
Deer screams are loud, and they're very piercing. They're almost like a bay or a higher pitched. You can understand what they are if you're familiar with them. If you're not, they're gonna throw you off. You know, you're gonna wonder what it is. But from what I've read and understood, and even talking with witnesses who've heard these Bigfoot screams, and I, like I said, I've heard things that I can't explain that came from very powerful lungs, very, very loud, and almost like through an amplifier, like a bullhorn.
The ones I've heard almost sound otherworldly.
Yeah, yeah.
Very weird.
But as far as deer screams, I'm seeing a lot of comments. Yeah, they're shrill. They can be shrill at times, and I would agree with that. Bigfoot screams have often been described as a woman being murdered or raped.
Like a cat.
Very similar to a cat, right. But the family that heard these screams that night in the woods, they were very quick to differentiate the difference between the two. They'd heard the cougar screams before, the mountain lion screams, and they said these things were so loud, it was like the roar of King Kong, as the father described it.
Here's a question from Tesla Mike in the chat. Is there any evidence any more evidence outside of the deer incident that shows evidence of tool usage?
Not that I'm aware of. In this case, no.
Seems
what's
like
interesting about this case was the investigators who talked to the witnesses told me that the family felt that the deer was killed by something that used an object to beat it over the head with. And
mm-hmm.
to me, that's almost like tool usage.
Yeah, it is tool usage. It's tool to kill. We've really refined that art, the human race, huh?
Right. But again, I have to go back to my objective logical thinking. You know, an animal wasn't seen doing this. A person wasn't seen doing this. So we can't say definitively what killed the deer. We can only speculate.
Right. Okay. There's an earlier question from the chat room. Have there been any reports of Bigfoot attacking a human?
There have been some cases, very, very few rare cases. Of course, there's the 1920s case from up in Washington. And I just drew a blank. I hate when that happens. Don't you?
Oh, and you're not even blonde, man. You can't even use the blonde excuse, dude.
I can't
you're
use that
soft.
Excuse. Up at Mount St. Helens.
Okay.
And they named the canyon for the incident Ape Canyon because of what happened to Fred Beck and the mining crew that were there. They were attacked in the middle of the night by what they claimed were giant monsters or demons, hairy demons, as they called them, and the story of that goes, it was, I think, 1923 or 24, the years escaped me, but they were mining, prospecting up in that area, and they had seen a creature, shot it, and it fell into a ravine, and they never recovered the body. And that night, in their cabin, these upright creatures attacked their cabin, raining boulders down on their cabin from the ridge above, trying to break into the cabin door, beating on the walls of the cabin, and the crew and his, or not crew, but Fred Beck and his crew fought them off by shooting rifles through the ceiling and through the walls and just basically defending themselves throughout the night. And the next morning they found boulders all scattered throughout the canyon that they were, that the cabin was in, and they found very large human-like footprints. And, of course, they fled down the mountain that day and they told their story to the press. That's a case where one of the very rare cases where a creature supposedly attacked humans. The other one comes from the very famous book, A Wilderness Hunter, from one of our former presidents, President Roosevelt, wrote about a trapper named Bauman who was in the, I believe it was the Idaho Mountains, and went up into an area that was told to him by the Native Americans to stay out of. They said it was cursed and it was not a good area to go in to hunt or trap. Well, Bauman discounted these tales and these warnings as nothing more than fabrication. So he took himself and his partner, and they went up into this area and were going to spend some time up there trapping. While they were up there trapping, a Bigfoot-like creature came into the area they had their lean-to at, and basically it would sneak around their lean-to at night. They fired at it. Shot at it, and while they were out doing their trapping and setting their traps, it would come in and wreck their lean-to, and it did it a couple times, and finally they had enough with this creature, enough experiences with this creature, so they decided to gather up their traps and leave. And while they were out, about noon, maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun was pretty high in the sky, and they felt pretty comfortable. You know, they didn't think they'd be attacked by this creature, so they decided to split up. And Bauman's partner went back to the campsite to ready the campsite, pack everything up to get ready to leave, while Bauman gathered the rest of the traps. And upon returning to the campsite, Bauman found his partner dead. His neck was broken, and very large fang marks were found in the side of his neck. And very human-like footprints were found all over the body, not all over the body, but around the body and around the campsite. And Bauman just grabbed his pack and hightailed it out of there and left his partner up there in the area. Whether or not that legitimately happened, we really don't know. There's nothing documented on it. It's just a story that President Roosevelt wrote in his book, The Wilderness Hunter, and it's based on a story that he was told by a trapper. So
Yeah.
Those are just a few examples of cases that have happened and have been reported, supposedly, these creatures attacking people. But my thinking is, logically, if these animals are animals, you know, even if they're a wild human, as some speculate, or a relative of human, if they're provoked, if you provoke their mm-hmm. food source, their young, if they're in danger, if they feel threatened, sure they're going to defend themselves. And any animal, if you back an animal into a corner or you provoke an animal, eventually it's going to attack you.
Sure. There was a report, and you might remember this, I had seen it on a documentary, where one fellow said that he was essentially kidnapped by a group and that he of Bigfoot, and he was able to get away.
Right. That's the Albert Othman case. And that was a gentleman who went up into British Columbia to do some prospecting.
Mm-hmm.
And the basics of the story is, while he was camping, something would come into his campground at night and rummage through his packs and dump his food. And one night he decided to stay awake and see what this thing was coming around. He put his rifle in his sleeping bag and wait for this thing to come around. Eventually he dozed off. And while he was sleeping, he was awoken to something picking him up and carrying him off from his campsite, about 3 hours, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
This thing carried him, and he was pretty much tucked inside his sleeping bag, so we didn't see what it was. And it carried him off, and a good 3 hours of walking. And if I remember the story correctly, he said it was the most uncomfortable feeling he'd ever felt. You could feel this animal that was walking, going up and down ravines and hills. And long and short of it, he came to after he was put down. He came out of his sleeping bag, and he was surrounded by a family of Bigfoot-type creatures, four of them, a mother, a father, and two juvenile, a male and female. And he was held captive in this canyon by these creatures for a little while. I believe it was a week or so, or a few weeks, if I'm not mistaken. And the only way he escaped was to trick the father into eating some of his snuff, his chewing tobacco.
Mm.
And when he gave the male creature the chewing tobacco, it dumped the whole can in its mouth and swallowed it and got real sick. And when it did, he made a break for it. But unfortunately, with that story, I've heard over the years that a lot of Bigfoot researchers think that that story was nothing more than a hoax or a fabrication. So.
Yeah, you know, even like the one that, was it Roosevelt that told? You know, I mean, two guys go up to the woods and one gets killed. I mean, that's, in my opinion, more reminiscent of human behavior than a Bigfoot, especially because if that was the case, why don't we have a lot more reports of Bigfoot attacking humans? You know, it seems to be the most of them, at least from what I've heard, Bigfoot don't want to really interact with humans. They tend to shy away from humans.
Right. Right. That's the commonality of a lot of the reports, the majority of reports, is they're shy, very docile animals.
Mm-hmm.
They're more curious than anything else. And once they're discovered, they hightail it out of Dodge. You know?
Right.
They take off. They don't stick around. So a lot of these stories, you know, we can only take as a grain of salt because you know, there is no conclusive proof that they actually happened, and they're very, very rare instances. But again, my logical thinking says that if this is an animal, you have to treat it like an animal and respect it as an animal, and understand
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't have the same traits as an animal.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained, you know, if you get into a situation where you're backing into a corner, or you threaten its young or its food source, sure, it's going to defend itself.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Here's some questions from the chat room. Are you convinced that Bigfoot are omnivores, eating both animal and plant?
I believe they're omnivores, and that's based on a lot of the reports that we've collected, not just myself, but researchers over the decades that we've been investigating, talking about them eating anywhere from small animals, fish, creatures being seen picking leaves and berries off of plants and bushes and eating them, corn, fruit. So I would have to think that they're omnivores, much like bears are.
Mm-hmm.
I call them opportunists myself. They take the opportunity to eat whatever they can find. because there have been reports of these creatures rummaging through dumpsters looking for food. So I call them opportunists.
So Dusty wants to know, have teeth ever been found? And for that matter, any bones of any sort that can't be identified? It seems like there have been some bones.
Well, there was a case, and this is more towards the Gigantopithecus as far as the teeth goes. There are cases over in China and India where they have found fossil remains of large molars in caves, and they, of course, attributed that to the Gigantopithecus blackie, which is the largest ever known primate to walk the earth. Of course, it's extinct now, or we think it's extinct now. There very well could be bones in the drawer of some museum somewhere or some anthropology department somewhere that just were assumed to be bear or human, you know, they're thrown in a drawer and not thought of. That's a distinct possibility. But as far as I know, there haven't been any bones collected or studied. There have been stories and speculation over the years that skeletal remains have been found, especially down in Falk, Arkansas, but most folks determined that was a large cat. As far as I'm aware of, there haven't been anything collected as far as teeth or bones of a Bigfoot creature. Mm-hmm. And even if there was, we really have nothing to label it. I mean, if there was
compare it with,
it would be listed as unknown.
What about that scalp or whatever they have over in, I think it's Tibet? If they have a scalp in a clear box, glass?
Yeah, they had a scalp over there, but I believe that was proven to be a fake.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually, the hide of one of their elk over there, or not their elk, but their one of the deer species. The name escapes me at the top of my head, but I thought I read about that years ago that was actually determined to be.
Yeah, that's what I'd heard too. All right, well, here's another question from Tesla Mike. Do you think what's going on in Bigfoot research is reminiscent of the time period before the discovery of mountain gorillas, with all the urban legends, myths, and varying reports of different types of Bigfoot?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities there. There's what's really sad about the whole Bigfoot phenomenon right now, it actually happened with the mountain gorillas. There aren't a lot of scientists involved in the study. Most of them are scoffing at it and making fun of it. And just basically ruling it off as mass hysteria.
It's a
subculture that we've created to appease the need for folklore and urban legend. And that's the same mindset that pretty much occurred going back to the mountain gorillas. And, you know, they were just... Finally, some scientists started to take it seriously, which Bigfoot, in the same situation, was finally starting to get some scientists to take the phenomenon seriously. And eventually, mountain gorillas were discovered and studied, and as we know, they're an endangered species, but you know, they were proven to exist. And that's what it's going to take is experienced, skilled scientists to start to look into the phenomenon a little more seriously and to take the circumstantial evidence that's been collected. And even some of the evidence that's been collected, the hair samples or the blood samples or whatever that's come back is unknown, to look at that and to try to compare it to, you know, a known species. And, you know, to really start to study that evidence that has been collected, because until the scientists are out there doing the work, right now all basically in the field are amateurs. Mm-hmm. It's folks like me and other members of our group. It's other enthusiasts who are out there, going out there on weekends, spending our own time, our own money, and a lot of us aren't scientifically trained. We learn, as I said, by trial and error. We go out there and we do what we can. We try to use common sense and logic, and we try to use some of the scientific principles that have been put in place, but a lot of us don't have the technical background or the forensics background to study these things. And DNA testing, quite honestly, costs thousands and thousands of dollars to get things analyzed, so... We try to save up the money. We try to get what we can get done and looked at. But until science finally says, okay, we're going to seriously look at this study, look at this phenomenon and study it, it's left up to us.
Well, here's a question from Dusty in the chat room. You know, if somebody did find a tooth or a bone or something, who would they send it to?
Well, there are some researchers out there, as I was explaining, there are some scientists who are starting to come forward to look at some of the evidence. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, associate professor out of Idaho State. Dr. John Bindernagel, he's a wildlife biologist from Vancouver Island in British Columbia. We are starting to get Dr. Henner Fehrenbach. He's a scientist, a retired scientist. He worked at the Oregon Primate Institute in Oregon. We are starting to get some scientists who are starting to take this subject seriously and look into the phenomenon. So if we run across something like that, through my networking and through other researchers who network, we can always shoot them an email and say, hey, we found something here, and you know, can you take a look at it? And usually they're pretty generous enough to take a look at it, and if it deems, you know, getting DNA tested on it or it calls for having further study done on it, they're willing to take those next steps because they have the connections to do so.
Now, in the same sentiment as the mountain gorilla, Sharon, hunter-gatherer, do you think it would be a good thing if these creatures are found, or is it better for them to remain hidden?
Oh, that's a great question.
It is.
I've often pondered that myself. Is it better to leave the mystery alone? Because it really does protect itself. It really does. Everything involved in it, the witnesses, you know, not being taken seriously, science not taking seriously, it really does protect itself. But in the same sense, if we do prove these animals exist, we can get them protected by the Endangered Species Act or some kind of laws on the books to protect them from being wiped out. So it's kind of a one-half dozen, you know what I mean? It's the one, one-half dozen the other.
Right. I mean, we would like to know, but if that becomes public knowledge, then you wonder if there are not some who would just want to go hunt them for the sport, you know, put a trophy on their wall, because there are some people like that, you know, and not everybody is benevolent and live and let live type of an attitude, and that's interesting. So some interesting stuff here. Well, where do you see the Bigfoot, where do you see Bigfoot research going?
Well, unfortunately, I don't see it progressing very much further than it has at this point, unless we can continue to get more and more scientists involved. We lost a big proponent who was a skeptic, mind you. He was a big-time skeptic up until recently, Professor Swindler. Darius Swindler was a primatologist and passed away recently. He was a diehard skeptic until he saw some evidence, and then he changed his stance on things and started to look into the phenomenon. And we need more folks in the field to continue what they're doing, first of all, even the amateurs, to continue to get out there and do what they do. But we also need more scientists to get actively involved and look at the work that the amateurs are doing and look at the evidence that we have collected. I mean, there's some dermal ridges on track casts that have been made from the 1970s that folks back then really, I mean, a common person would have thought dermal ridges on a track. I mean, that to me just, you know, that
amazing.
Screams authentic, you know, that screams coming from the foot not a known creature, but a live, living creature. And for the scientists not to take a look at that seriously, it just baffles me. And even some of the DNA that's been collected and not been able to be matched with a known mammal or known species of animal, that baffles me. Why scientists won't take a look at this? Because looking back, as we talked about the mountain gorillas, they were thought to be legend and lore. And they did the research and look what turned up.
What's the name? What's the name? His name escapes me, that forensics expert and primate expert in law enforcement. Do you remember his name offhand?
Jimmy Chilcutt.
Yeah. I mean, he's made, and like you were saying, to me, when he examines those, and he's a primate expert, dermal ridges, and obviously a fingerprint expert, you know, and he says, this does not fit any known pattern of primates or humans for that matter. So to me, that's an amazing thing. That gives a lot of scientific credibility that we're dealing with something that we're not aware of here, that we haven't cataloged scientifically.
Right. And my whole thing about that is the cast that he was looking at, these casts were taken decades ago. And it wasn't real common knowledge then. I mean, yes, we know about fingerprints on our hands and dermal ridges on our hands and feet, but for someone to fake that, to have the knowledge to fake that, to put those dermal ridges in those casts, it's just, I don't think anybody could have done that back then. And for him to look at those casts now and say, look, there's dermal ridges, and they don't match human, they don't match any known primate I have on file, the collection of dermal ridges and prints of primates that I have on file. And incidentally, he's printed hundreds of species of primate from all over the world. He has one of the largest collections of primate prints. And he matched this, and he's never seen anything like that before. And he's used by the Conroe, Texas Police Department, as well as other police departments, for his forensics ability, his knowledge, and his expertise. He's just not some common Joe off the street. And why people, especially scientists, aren't looking at this evidence and saying, wow, it just baffles me.
Well, and same with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. I mean, you know, they are scientists in the field who are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe we do have something unknown. I mean, I saw that, I think it was a Monster Quest episode with Jeff Meldrum, where they were on that remote place, was in an island or up in the mountains, very remote, had to fly in, and they had rocks thrown at their house. They had, you know, or the cabin they were in. They had a lot of experiences there as well. And this is something that I think, this is personal opinion now, but after talking with you and with the knowledge that I have in other areas, ufology, hauntings, here's the bottom line with a lot of this, and I'm just kind of speak globally now. We don't have the ability to replicate different events scientifically. For example, a haunting. You know, we can't ask a ghost to appear on command. With UFOs, we can't, most of us can't ask for a UFO to appear. We can't ask for an alien to come down and talk with us. We can't replicate these things or duplicate them scientifically. So a lot of mainstream science has said, you know, it's just bunk. There's nothing to it. And unfortunately, mainstream science has gone the wrong way. They have, in my opinion now, they are being untrue to the true scientific method, which means let's investigate this. Let's investigate it with an open mind and find out what the answers are, regardless of what those answers are and wherever that takes us, whatever that means. Instead, they want to, you know, put it into their box, and that's just not going to happen. And so then you take people like yourself and other researchers such as us, myself, we look at these things, we look at them with a rational, objective mind, yes, a scientific mind, and we say, hey, you know, we can't explain this. You know, it doesn't fit. The circumstances don't fit anything that's known, and yet it happened. And so I think that there is a turn, at least in my opinion, and it's happened with me. There's a it's like a new approach almost. Let me explain. You know, in certain areas of paranormal research, you can't duplicate it scientifically, but yet something's going on. Now, much of it can be explained with psychology, and yes, some of it can be explained with mass hysteria. Some of it can be explained with fantasy-prone people. Yes, some of it can, but not all of it. And so some of these really high-end cases that represent high strangeness, something's going on, and yet we can't duplicate it. So what are we to make of it? I'm not sure I'm being clear here, but what I'm saying is that we've got to look at the evidence that we have and keep going, because when you've got an event that happened, you can't prove what caused it, but yet you know it happened, we're still left with an actual event. Does that make sense?
Oh, it certainly does. Right. And that's, I think, honestly, this what we're doing, we're pioneers.
Yes, yes.
And if you look back through history, a lot of the things that we have today, we know about today, there were pioneers who went through the same bunking and debunking. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Columbus, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
They told them the world was flat.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a lot of these people who are well-known and they're big scientists in our eyes went through a lot of the stuff that we're going through. You know, it took them years to prove these things existed, and a lot of determination, a lot of perseverance, a lot of their own money, a lot of their own personal time to get an answer. Unfortunately, science has failed us quite a bit.
Yeah.
We know that.
A lot.
Yeah, they failed us quite a bit. But the public in general and mainstream media, really, they look at science as the end-all, be-all. If it's not scientifically proven, it doesn't exist.
Right.
Whether it's hauntings, ghosts, UFOs, anything in the paranormal realm, it doesn't exist. You know, and we've been brainwashed into believing that. What science says is the absolute. And I just don't buy into that.
Well, I don't either. I mean, for example, you know, when we were doing the Stan Romanek investigation a month ago, I actually saw UFOs for the first time, 7 of them in a staggered V formation flying at between 10 and 20,000 feet, a guesstimate, and going, in my opinion, in excess of 5,000 miles an hour. Now, I look at that, and they were not jet fighters. There was no sonic boom. There was no sound. There was nothing. Yet, I saw that, and well, many of us saw it. Okay, something happened. Now, can I prove that that was an extraterrestrial craft? No. Can I prove it was a human craft? No. I do believe that it was not human because our technology simply is not that. And people say, well, how do you know what our technology is? Believe me. You know, if we're to that point, then we're way more advanced than I would have ever speculated. And so we have evidence of something that happened. So now I look at that and say, okay, what am I to say? Do I say, well, you know, I still can't prove ETs exist? You know, to hell with that BS. Look, something was there, and I'm not the only one who saw it. That's not the only sighting. Something's going on. Now, is it true that some UFO sightings are bogus or not real? Or yeah, sure. Okay, but that one wasn't. That was a real one. You know, we also got an AVP, anomalous voice phenomenon, that same investigation, that after rigorous forensic analysis, we can't explain. We can't explain how it happened, how it was delivered. There's no evidence that there was any hoax involved. And so now we're left with an event that we don't understand how it was pulled off. It was presumably pulled off by ETs, and it's in the Paranexus forum, by the way, if you want to listen to that. And, you know, so what I'm trying to say here is that the time has come where we say, you know what, enough with science. Or mainstream science is what I'm talking about. Let's get educated. The same thing we were talking about earlier on in this program. Read up. Study forensic analysis of whatever genre you want, whether it's, you know, research site forensics, or whether it's video forensics, or audio forensics, or whatever it is. We need, as a paranormal research community, to step up to the plate because, frankly, there ain't many scientists who are doing it. We need to fill that gap. We need to educate ourselves because there's no reason why we can't. I got passionate. Sorry, get off on a tangent.
That's quite all right. I'm in agreement with you. I try to remain as objective as possible, but yet with an open mind. And the reason I try to remain objective as possible and try to follow the scientific rules and procedures and methods that have been put in place, the scientific theory, is because what I explained, you know, the public has been spoon-fed.
Yes.
Either this way or it's nothing. And my mind frame and my mindset, I would love to sit here and say what I experienced was a Bigfoot, because I am really leaning towards what was out there could have been a human.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no rational explanation, but I know that, and I've always been careful, and I always try to teach this to anybody I talk with, you have to be careful about what you say, because if you start speculating and throwing things out there. Mm-hmm. I experienced this is what happened. The general public is going to hear you and say, well, where's your proof? Because they've been spoon-fed all these years that science is this way. And you have no proof to back it up, so you're lying.
Right.
You
don't forget
hysteria.
And don't forget that you're in it for the money thing. Don't forget that part.
I've heard that before, too.
Oh, yeah, the lame fallback.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, I have to be careful about what I say.
Sure, we all do.
And I have to, I think all of us as researchers have to be careful
sure.
how to present the evidence that we find, even though we know the truth that's going on. We know what we've experienced.
Right.
We know
right.
what we found. Because if you go out to the public and say, this is a Bigfoot track, and this is a Bigfoot scream, and this is Bigfoot evidence, or this is ghost evidence, or UFO evidence, they're going to say, where's your proof?
Yes, and here's the thing, though. That's what I'm trying to say. In this field, we can't use the same guidelines that an atomic scientist uses to understand atomic theory or an archaeologist might. What I'm saying is that we look at these, like, for example, that anomalous voice phenomena. It happened. We have that. Now, was it human orchestrated or was it ET orchestrated? I don't know, but after examining, and I'm talking about stringently examining the entire situation, the evidence, we can neither prove nor disprove the authenticity of that. However, the preponderance of evidence suggests that it was originated by extraterrestrials. Now, that's the official. So that's what I'm saying. Like your experience in the woods where you saw this thing moving and moving fast, you look at the big picture, and that's what we've got to do as paranormal researchers. We've got to step back from it. We got to look at all the different things. And I think that the paranormal research community is uniquely qualified to examine a greater spectrum of possibilities than perhaps some of the mainstream scientists, because they're, first of all, they are predisposed. It doesn't exist. That's the predisposition. So now everything that they come up with is within those parameters. It doesn't exist. What we're saying is we're open-minded. It could exist. It may not exist. We don't know. What does the evidence suggest? And that's what the point I'm trying to make. Now let me throw a couple of questions because we're coming up here. We got a few minutes left, but I want to get some of these questions out at you.
Sure.
If I can find them in the chat room, I'm sure you've read them. Let's see. Do you think that the fear of being ridiculed, needing a paycheck, is why scientists don't get involved?
Well, the late Grover Krantz, he worked at Washington State University as an anthropologist, and he was denied promotions and pay increases because of his research in Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
And he, many interviews that he was on television with or in films, he regretted doing it, but he said the work needed done.
Mm-hmm.
He came right out and said, I don't enjoy doing this work, but it needs to be done. And
ethics.
I think a lot of researchers are afraid to get involved with the scientific researchers because there hasn't been anything conclusive brought forward yet. And I think maybe someday if that big piece of conclusive evidence comes out, you might see a whole bunch of people jump on board. But what I do think is interesting, though, is we are starting to see that trickle effect one by one. These scientists, Meldrum and Bindernagel,
mm-hmm.
and Fehrenbach, they're starting to come out, and they're starting to look at this stuff, and they're starting to say, wait a minute. Like Meldrum talks about the mid-tarsal break in the tracks. It has to be that mm-hmm. is there to support the weight of a creature. Nothing else could do that
mm-hmm.
or leave that mid-tarsal break.
Mm-hmm.
So we're starting to get these scientists to come out just a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but not as much as I'd like to see. And I think it might be because they're afraid of what their colleagues are going to say.
Oh, yeah.
Poor
tenure.
Poor Jeff. He had actually colleagues in his field and at the university trying to get him expelled from school. They wanted him out. They were trying to get him removed from the college.
He's such a great guy. I have a lot of respect for Jeff Meldrum. I'd love to get him on the show sometime. There's another question from Mike, or no, this is from Sharon, hunter-gatherer. Is there any evidence that these sightings take place along ley lines?
We do have some reports of that, yes. The majority of reports that we do receive, or at least that I've studied, are the big common thread is waterways. Ponds, lakes,
right.
rivers, creeks, waterways. That's
which makes sense for an animal or a human.
Right. That's where we tend to get a lot of the reports from, is waterways.
Hmm. All right, I'm just looking at the chat room, making sure I got all of the questions. If I missed any questions in the chat room, please repost it if you would, and I'll make sure I get it out. So let's talk now about how can the Bigfoot community, Bigfoot research community, and frankly, the expanded paranormal research community work better together?
Well, the one thing that I've always seen in a number of years, and it's gotten worse in our community in particular, is the we're our own worst critics. And you know, instead of working together and sharing the information and working to solve the mystery, we've got to critique everything that comes out. And I think that's okay to a point to critique things, because we don't want to become so gullible to believe anything that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if somebody finds something that's definitely worth looking at and worth following up on, right away everybody jumps on the bandwagon, this person's full of crap. They have no idea what they're talking about. Instead of at least giving that person the benefit of the doubt to look at all the information and then make a rational determination about it, right away everybody's critical of it. And there's a lot of fighting, a lot of backbiting, backstabbing. And I think a lot of that has to do with the people want to be the, somebody wants to be the first one to solve this mystery. There's a lot of ego involved.
And, yeah.
The thing that's missing, and I'm sure it's relevant in UFO study and ghost study, is everybody wants to be that big person. And what's missing is the sharing of information.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, this is what I've learned in the field, and the next researcher taking that information and expanding on it and using what he's learned and then in turn sharing what he learned with that other person, that's missing. And I've always been a big proponent of sharing what I've learned, teaching those who are willing to take a few minutes to listen to me, what tips I've learned, what works for me, what doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had an open door policy, and there's a few people in the chat room tonight that know me, that know that I'm that type of person, to invite anybody to work with me. Anybody that wants to work with me in the field, whether they're a paranormalist thinking Bigfoot's an interdimensional creature, whether they believe Bigfoot's a human, whether they believe Bigfoot's a primate, whatever their beliefs are, I'm willing to work with that person. I may not believe everything they say or agree with everything they say, but I'm willing to work with that person and learn what they're talking about. And we even have people in our group with different mind frames. Some people think Bigfoot's from an alien dimension, or from a UFO. Some people think that...
Well, there's that speculation.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't agree with that, because a lot of the evidence that we're finding points in the opposite direction, but I don't attack those people for their beliefs.
Right.
I'm willing to hear them out.
And
that's what's missing.
And that's what we need to... That's what we as paranormal researchers need to keep in mind. There is far too much politics, far too much backbiting, bickering, petty griping, accusations without foundation. And that's going to be across any kind of field. But you know what, folks? We are different. We are really exploring and researching an area that has potentially great impact on the human race and on what it means to be human. And we've got to set an example. And so resist the petty infighting. Resist the accusations. Watch how you write your emails and your posts. I mean, I've been dealing with this too for a long time. And, people misunderstand. Give people the benefit of the doubt. It's okay. What I'm looking for from my team members and from other people is objective feedback. I don't want somebody to pass judgment on something, without all the evidence. Give me some objective feedback. Don't give me what you feel. Don't tell me what, I don't feel this is true. Well, that's okay, but tell me why. What's wrong with it? Why is it true? Why is it not true? Give me objective feedback. And work together. That's why I have a policy too. I don't compete with anybody. I'm in this to find answers, and I don't have to be the one to find them. I just want to find them. And so I'm willing, just like you, Eric, I have an open door policy. I'll work with you. I'll share with you. I'll help you. We're all in this together. That's frankly why Paranexus was born, to share information. And I urge our members who are listening to this, get into Paranexus, post stuff, post your feedback, post your evidence, share what you found, share your tips, tools, and techniques. Be a part of the solution of this, and let's set a new standard in the paranormal research community at large to show them how it ought to be done.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. one thing that I was taught from the beginning from my mentor, Stan Gordon, who I've learned over the years, is he doesn't get involved in the politics. He stays out of it. He does his own thing. He researches what he finds, he puts out there, and he says, you know, we don't have the answers. This is what we're finding. This is the evidence we're collecting. We don't have the answers. Whether you like it or not, this is what we're finding. And I try to stay out of the politics. I get involved in, unfortunately, defending my friends. I fiercely defend my friends because friendship to me is something that's very important, and I defend as many people as I can. I hate with a passion to see the fighting going on, and I'll jump right in the fray of things to stop it because there's no place for it.
Exactly.
But my mentor, Stan, has always taught me, and I've tried to teach one of my closest friends, Sean Forker, who's in the room tonight, can tell you, I've always tried to teach that, you know, we need to work together. That's the bottom line. Whether it's across all the paranormal fields or it's in your own your area of expertise, hauntings, UFOs, whatever the case may be, Bigfoot, we need to work together. We need to put aside this mentality that I'm better than you, you're better than me, that kind of thinking. None of us truly have the answers.
Right.
And we're finding them little bits at a time. And
right.
in order to solve this one way or the other, we have to put these pieces of the puzzle together. And you may be holding the piece of the puzzle that I need, and I'm holding something that you need.
Right.
And that's the only way we're going to do it. And there's no reason for the fighting. There really isn't.
No.
I've been bashed and I've been attacked and I've been called quite a few names for standing up for that, but I won't back down from that stance. I refuse to.
Yeah, my latest name from a group in Illinois is Ass Monkey. So
I haven't been called that yet.
let me ask Dusty's question, the final question from the chat room that she'd asked earlier on. Does the technology of satellite mapping and things like Google Earth help in finding hotspots in the interior forest while doing Bigfoot research? Have you ever thought about that?
Yes, it does, because we can see a trend of where the activity is.
Cool.
Google Earth really has a great feature now that a lot of researchers are starting to take advantage of, and that's being able to see the terrain. And if we see a lot of reports coming out of that terrain, we can then look for other areas of similar terrain to see if there's activity there. So it is helping, yes.
Great.
It's a great tool to use.
Well, great. Well, talk about your website again. Tell us the website and where people can go to learn more.
Sure. It's PABigfootSociety.com, and we encourage everybody to check it out. If you're interested in Bigfoot, if you have any questions or whatever, my email address is on there. My home phone number is on there. Actually, my cell phone number is on there. I don't hide from anybody. I'm really easy to get a hold of.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be, if I can plug our conference real
quick.
Yeah,
please.
You're going to be in the eastern United States in late September, September 27th to be exact. Here in Pennsylvania, we are having an East Coast Bigfoot Conference. We've got some of the most respected Bigfoot researchers in the eastern United States going to be speaking at this event and talking about their research and what they're finding, and it's a great family event. If you ever had an interest in Bigfoot, anything at all regarding Bigfoot, come out and check it out. And no, John Cartwright, I am not a Bigfoot rock star.
I think you are. Okay, so cool. And we've got less than a minute left to go here. So, Eric, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. Absolutely awesome interview. Really appreciate all of your knowledge, and great to have you as a consultant for Paranexus. And thanks for taking your time with us tonight, man.
Well, thank you for having me on, Doug. It's been a real pleasure and honor to talk with you. I got to throw a quick thank you out to Dusty for contacting me and getting this whole ball rolling. I've had a great amount of respect for Dusty.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart.
And for the group that you guys are running down in Florida, I'm honored to be a part of it, and I'm honored to be associated with Paranexus.
Well, very kind of you. And if you'll hang with me after we close for a minute, I appreciate it. And I just want to tell our listeners, please go to paranexus.org if you want to. A quick link to Eric's website, go to paranexusradio.org. It'll take you directly to the radio program scheduling. You can click on the link there. And we just launched a new website, a division of Paranexus, called ParazoneTV.com. ParazoneTV.com. There is a link on Paranexus. It's a great video, audio, and image sharing website. We'd love to have you come free. Sign up, share your videos, your paranormal-related stuff. We'd love to have you a part of that. Next week, we still have yet to finalize the guests, so I'm not able to announce that, but Please be with us next Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll have another great show. We appreciate everybody in the chat room and all of our listeners taking the time to listen to the show. Appreciate your feedback, and if you know anybody you'd like to see on the show, let us know. With that, bid you adieu. Have a great week. Thanks so much.
Universe.